Okay, so two talks. I thought it. I took it upon myself to dedicate the first one to the first turning of the Dharma wheel, which is the original presentation of the Buddha's teaching, which I talked about in some detail last night. However, last talk. The point about all this stuff is it has to make sense in terms of your personal experience, not just because that's polite and good training methods and so on, but that's kind of how the Dharma works. If you can't relate that to your direct experience, there's something wrong with the transmission. You know, well, it might be you as well, but I think I'm responsible for the transmission, not on the other end. So this has to be as related as possible to direct experience. And because this can seem like very lofty, arcane and difficult stuff, then, you know, there's a bit of a challenge there. So I addressed that last time by saying, okay, I'm going to demonstrate this stuff in terms of direct experience. So I got people to hold their breaths in the mindfulness of breathing. Might be a bit of a first that. Breathe in and hold it, breathe out and hold it, and discover that if you don't alternate your breaths with a reasonable frequency, quite a lot of dukkha arises quite fast and you have to stop. So there's a rhythm there that asserts itself, and you can't do anything about that, which is kind of interesting when we consider it's an object of meditation. And the middle way, therefore, is defined of something being about the in-breath and the out-breath, which appear to be opposites but are not. They're actually complements of the same thing. There's something there which is neither the in-breath nor the out-breath. There's some combination of the two. And when that balance is right, an extraordinary amount of possibility opens up. It is not a simple balance of the breaths. It is life itself, at least for carbon-based air-breathing mammals. And that is the basis of the middle way, as I said. I then spent the second half of the talk, demonstrated it in terms of a visual illusion as well here. If you look at that, you will see that you cannot hold the vase or the faces for any length of time. They alternate. So the same thing is happening with the breath is happening with the visual perception as well. That's a shifting figure. It will not sit still, not for long. Yeah? Have a go at really holding that vase and the faces will just come at you, like the in-breath comes at you when you try to hold it. So there's something fundamental to the operations of being there, I think. And the second part was devoted to various encounters in the life of the Buddha, principally his near-death experience, rescued by Sujata after his period of extreme ascetic practice. And my view, at least, that was a near-death experience which promoted a fundamental insight experience which became the idea of the middle way, which I think he took to Bodh Gaya, sat under the tree and decided to explore, and that's what opened it up, and that's why we're all here today, without that having happened. So it's notable that the Buddha failed to transmit his experience on two occasions before he got to his old mates, the five ascetics at the Deer Park at Sarnath. And the very first thing that he successfully transmitted was the idea of the middle way to Kandanya, who goes down in history because of it. And is known as Anya Kandanya, which is a pun that only works in Pali, I think, but it means Kandanya who gets it, who knows, who twigged, who spotted it, who went, ah, gotcha. So what I was trying to do there is demonstrate how the middle way is absolutely central to any understanding of anything that can reasonably be called Buddhist, but also it's right there in your immediate experience. So the emptiness and the middle way are entirely ordinary. Yeah, that's my claim. But entirely ordinary in a Buddhist context may not quite mean what it seems. Emptiness, then, is the self-evident truth within experience when it is carefully considered. I'll say that again because it's really important. If you don't give attention to your experience, you'll miss this. You won't see it. So what we do as Dharma practitioners is we pay very close attention to our experience. And when we do that, it alters. And what we discover is that there are actually no permanent things at all. Only contingent mental constructions. Okay, jargon alert on the contingent. They're contingent because they have no independent existence. That which is contingent depends upon something outside itself for its existence. And already you can see that the face of the vase, the out-breaths, might be an example of that in your plain experience. As the Tibetans are fond of saying, they have no existence from their own side. And sometimes Tibetan teachers will put a pile of twigs up. And then pull one away, they'll all collapse, because they're all depending on each other, sort of wigwam style, if you like, to illustrate that point. So they come and go, and they go and come, and they have no boundary beyond that of a mere idea. and they always depend upon each other for their supposedly separate and unique identity. All of which is clearly manifest in our experience, provided that we pay attention, which is why we go on such a lot in the tradition about paying attention. Because without that, without the mindfulness, nothing's going anywhere, really. Upon careful examination, we find that the supposed things upon which we build our lives actually have no fixed existence. The vase depends upon the faces. The faces depend upon the vase. The in-breath is only the in-breath because it depends upon the out-breath. And the out-breath is only the out-breath because it depends upon the in-breath. One of my psychotherapist friends says that in the self-other relationship, the most interesting thing is the hyphen. Think about that one. Now, for sure there is breath. Any fool knows that. But show me the one who breathes. Where is there anywhere to be found a breather? Soto Zen Master Shunryu Suzuki says, the breath is just a swinging door. When we say, I breathe, the I is extra. There is no you to say I. It's one of my favourite little phrases, that. There is no you to say I. It doesn't get much more diamond-like than that. And if you want to understand that, just pay close attention to your experience, because it really is right there under your nose. It is a cornerstone of the Buddhist tradition that enlightenment is a very, very long way away and very, very close indeed at one and the same time. It's here and it's not. And it's both of those things. This is the wisdom to be found in balancing on one leg. Neither to right nor to left, but if I can do it. Or simply in riding your bicycle along the street. Are we really going to call this religion or philosophy? Is this what the Buddha discovered? And what he communicated to others in those various encounters which we discussed in my last talk? For me, it's the peculiar genius of the Buddha to have discovered and communicated a middle way which is not a mere compromise. The middle way is not the muddle way. It's not the middle of the road. It's the only real way forward, precisely because it avoids all the extremes. And it follows from that that what we in this movement have a way of calling the spiritual life cannot be kept in a box. It is not all sweetness and light, nor is it a futile, unending, bloody struggle in the gathering darkness. Anyone who has made any sort of honest attempt to live it knows that it is both, and therefore neither. Anyone agree with that? Put your hand up if you agree with that. Okay, got a few hands. Since we can never know where the middle is without going to the extremes, which might be what Blake meant about the road to accessing the Palace of Wisdom, perhaps, it follows that the middle way is a twisted and a winding road. A sly Grateful Dead quote here, no simple highway, but a steep mountain track. Tough going sometimes, but the views are amazing and they get better as you climb. Well worth the walk. Ask anyone who knows, there is a classic form to the spiritual life. It starts, like any new relationship, in a wild rush of enthusiasm. But if it's going anywhere, it will sooner or later hit a crisis, the first row. It ends if you just give up at that point. And it continues if you find a way through. And that oscillation between smooth and rough does not stop. But in the end, you do see through it. So I'm going to offer you a model for finding your way through in the spiritual life. I'm going to suggest to you that there are four levels to think about. Now, first of all, there is what I'm going to call Dharma, which is completely inexpressible. And the less you say about it, the better, because it's possible to make a bit of a fool of yourself trying to talk about it, really. It is the inexpressible. It is well beyond concept. It's a direct experience of truth. It is what the Buddha realized beneath the Bodhi tree. It is a moment of pure direct experience. It cannot be captured conceptually, but you can point at it, you can indicate it, you can use symbols, you can hint at it. And in that sense, all the words and all the concepts in the entire tradition are just empty. And their only meaning is that they point towards it, which is why form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. So that's Dharma. And if we add the definite article, we get the Dharma. which is the minimum amount of elegant and skillful conceptualization that you can bring to bear upon that. So it's the best kind of finger pointing at the moon. It's the best book that inspires you to practice. It's the cleverest exposition of ideas, which is of no inherent worth whatsoever, except insofar as it makes you go, I'm going to practice, I'm going to get on that cushion, I'm going to do it, I'm going to be better, I'm going to get on with it. That's the link. So where's Buddhism in all this? Well, Buddhism is the next one down, really, which is Buddhism considered as a philosophy, as just another religion, or as an ideology, if you like, as a framework of belief. Right? And that is very, very useful because it provides you with a very practical framework for working with. It gives you a resort, an answer to your questions, a way to frame your questions, something to operate within. It is actually a very long way from the truth, but it points at it from rather further away than the Dharma does. And good exposition of Buddhism will become the Dharma. Yeah? But in order to survive in this complicated and impermanent world, we have this order, this movement, which was founded by a lot of people who were not terribly enthusiastic about organised religion, and so set up a sort of disorganised religion, I suppose, in a way. Those of you who know the history. You have to make some compromises and provide some structure. And so Buddhists spend an awful lot of time with the Heart Sutra egging them on, really, to say all of this is just a contingent structure. It's just a framework. It's just there to help, which makes it incredibly valuable until you take it too seriously, too literally, which is a bit like eating the menu rather than eating the meal, or standing at the signpost and thinking that you've reached the destination. Yeah, getting stuck in fixed views and rituals, and the fixed idea that I am a Buddhist is an inherent contradiction, really. But you have to hold both of those things. The fourth level is something called Shuddhism, which used to be much more prominent in this movement than it is now. So some of the Shuddhism I've heard is that my study of psychology was essentially a waste of time, that staying with my girlfriend, we've been together for 39 years, silver wedding celebration this August, and I'd be lost to the spiritual life. Well, it seems that they got that one right. And you'll hear examples, if you talk to people from the past, of arbitrary definitions of what it is to be Buddhist, which really have nothing much to do with the spiritual life at all, I would say. So this comes from my chapter, The Dharma Bums. There's one. You're one too, aren't you? Anybody who thinks a little bit like this is probably a Dharma Bum as well. Shuddhism is something that looks a little bit like Buddhism, but on closer examination proves to be contingent, proves to be not terribly useful. This is why you should not allow yourself to fall under the influence of any order. My advice to you is to talk to a lot, listen to a lot, take a very broad approach. We provide a diversity that means that you can get a lot of different views, a lot of different perspectives, and somehow we hold it together into a coherent whole. Multiple influences and diversity are very, very important, so do not believe what I'm telling you here. Okay? Ask someone who disagrees, ideally. So there you have it. At the top, we have the Dharma, and indeed that's everywhere, really. Then you have the Dharma, conceptual structures which point towards that. Buddhism, which points in the same direction from a bit further away, and has generated, how many written words has the Dharma, does this Buddhism generated? How many books on Buddhism? And Shuddhism, which is what happens when people try and do Buddhism, but sort of fail a bit, really. Yeah? The spiritual life is all about working within Buddhism, the Dharma, and Dharma. Yeah? Shuddhism, once you've detected it, just pass on by. Not easy to do. Because the issue is this, you see, when you hit one of those crises, is that you or is that them or what? Is this because I'm not doing it right, because the Dharma is starting to ask me questions which I can't answer? Or is it because the way they do things in Sri Ratna is just a bit sort of the way they do it and it's not that important? Very, very hard to know. We are a lot better at that than we used to be, I think. Shuddhism has declined and I don't mourn it. But you've got to ask yourself those questions, and the Buddha insists upon this as well. Yeah. So with that in mind, the Emperor Wu meets Bodhidharma. I spoke to you in my last talk about a lot of encounters, a lot of dialogue, some of it very crisp indeed, in which the Buddha puts across something which is greatly to the benefit of the person receiving it, who gets it, who understands it. And what do you think is going on there? So I want to suggest that that's a collision between Buddhism and Dharma. Okay? Dharma and the Dharma being pretty much bound together here, because the only way you can really know Dharma is through a conceptual presentation or direct experience. Lacking immediate Kensho, let's assume that we've only got the Dharma to work with. Right? I think the Emperor Wu represents Buddhism, if you like. He was a great emperor, he endowed many monasteries, he in many ways was the exemplary sort of spiritual king. But he was very proud of his achievement. Now, I've been reading a bit of history about Wu, I've been thinking about this talk, and discovered that actually he seems to have been quite a canny guy who used to distress his courtiers by disappearing for long periods on retreat and not sort of doing emperor stuff. So maybe he's not quite the, you know, the naive, literal practitioner that we see here, but very often you get this in Buddhist narrative, you get someone who is set up to ask the sort of dopey question and someone who knocks it down. And the idea is just to demonstrate this to the reader, that this is the real point, okay? So I would take Wu fairly seriously, actually. And there's not even any evidence that Wu and Bodhidharma met. The modern scholars delight in picking things apart and saying, oh, this never happened, and Hobo was six people and all that kind of stuff, you know? So, with a pinch of salt, you take it. Interestingly, they reckon that Wu represented sort of official orthodox Buddhism, and that Bodhidharma would never have met him because he represented a much more, I don't know, ragged trouser philanthropist kind of practice, really. Not official at all. And that tension between the official system, the structure, the party line and so on, and the people who have sort of stayed around this movement is there for everyone to see, really. It's an interesting tension, shall we say. Yeah. Now, there's a couple of polls for you, so I wonder what the middle way looks like. Get in the habit of doing that, thinking, well, if I'm given two opposites, which have their attractions and their downsides, where might the middle way be on this? You can make yourself very annoying like this, can't you? Bodhidharma represents the Dharma pointing at Dharma. Yeah? So are they in conflict or are they in agreement? They're a bit like the in-breath and the out-breath and the bars and the faces, aren't they? They're kind of on the same page, but they're not reading the same text at all. And so at last to Nagarjuna. I'll give you a bit of background on that, and then tell you how Nagarjuna might construct the encounter between the Emperor Wu and Bodhidharma. So I'm trying to find a way into this great work of Nagarjuna's, the Mullabhujamakarika, which I'll explain in due course, by going from your direct experience into that, our direct experience, and also the direct experience as illustrated by this conversation between Wu and Bodhidharma. I think it's a really important dialogue. And all the other dialogues I've spoken about, a bit like this as well, essentially people went to the Buddha and asked him a Buddhist question, and they got a Dharmic answer. And if they could manage that, and they could find out how that worked, you know, then they were away. That was it. That's the spark that lit the forest fire. I think I'm going to quote Mao Zedong in this talk. There you go. So, what would Nagarjuna make of this? Well, you have to go back 400 years or so before Wu met Bodhidharma, because Nagarjuna dates from the 2nd to 3rd century CE. The Wikipedia shot at his dates is 150 to 250 of the Common Era. So that kind of time, yeah? So that is something like 600, 700 years after the Buddha. And that matters, because Nagarjuna does something to what has happened to Buddhism after the Buddha. He is credited with the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma. And that's what this talk is about. What did Nagarjuna do to give the wheel of the Dharma another great spin? Yeah? To put it back where the Buddha intended it, in the kind of motion that he intended. And notice while we're there, we talk about a spinning wheel here. Nothing fixed, everything in movement. Yeah? The more you think dynamically in terms of flow, the non-fixity of things, the dynamics, the closer you are to what I think the Buddha's on about. Now, amusingly, there are two second Buddhas at least. One is Padmasambhava, you might have heard of, who founded Buddhism in Tibet along with Shantarakshita, about whom I better not say anything at all, but he seems to deserve the title, you'd think. But Nagarjuna gets equal billing with Padmasambhava, which is pretty big billing in the Buddhist world. And you'll often see him depicted as a monk in robes, a scholar. Not one of these kind of, as the Buddha's depicted here, pretty much in everyday clothing, I suppose. Not having an everyday experience there, but, you know, an everyday presentation. But if you look carefully, just Google Nagarjuna, images on Google, and you'll see he's got seven snakes, a halo of cobras around his head, which suggests something very deep indeed. Now, you must have told people that Nagarjuna got the Pranyaparamita Sutras from a mermaid. You've all heard that one? Yeah? Do you know about that?
Yeah, the Nagas and Naga King.
Cobras, Nagas, dragons, lizards. All represent very, very deep energies coming to the surface. If you look at the classic depiction of a dragon, very interestingly, you'll see a little tail and a rising body that definitely moves and writhes and twists, exploding in a halo of fire and flame. And that's where the action is, but it comes from the bottom. So there's something there about deep energy coming up into consciousness. Yeah? So that's cobras striking at Nagarjuna's spine into a halo of snakes. Well, to me, that's a pretty powerful image. Yeah? Those cobras are real. There's a picture you can find on the web somewhere in Cambodia of the Buddha on a huge pillar. And he's got these kind of nagas writhing around his head. And it's, you know, for a snake enthusiast like myself, you know, I've just described, I've got to go to Cambodia sometime and see that, you know.
But I think it's slightly mixed up with Hinduism in Cambodia. That's probably why they have them. It used to be Hindu.
Uh-huh.
Cambodia used to be Hindu, yeah. So they have so many snakes. So it's a little bit mixed up. They've sort of mixed up Buddhism and Hinduism a bit more than
the symbolism snakes. Might well be mixed up. I mean, if you read Vishvapani's biography of the Buddha, which is great, he has a lot to say about Nagas. And those of you who have heard of Mahakashipa, that's the fellow the Buddha held up the flower and only Mahakashipa smiled. He was formerly a Naga priest, according to Vishvapani's account. And he makes the Buddha sound like an awful lot more of a magician and a guy who could impress a fellow who made his living in a Hindu temple out of, you know, appeasing Nagas. This guy just joined his Sangha because of that. So I think there might well be some crossover there because, you know, the...
Well, one thing is, the Cambodians absolutely love the Hindu stuff as well. They kept all their snakes. You can see it everywhere. You know, it's like one of the most frequently seen Cambodian.
Yeah, there's definitely some crossover imagery there, but the line is not to be drawn. However, the point is, Nagas, the Naga in Nagarjuna, really, which is, you know, snake guy. You know, and that image of the mermaid coming up from below, and there's a great little picture of, and the perspective is all really weird, with Nagarjuna and Aryadeva, I think, sat there, and this mermaid proffering this little book. She's quite small, she'll be bigger, I think, really. So the idea is that the Pranyaparamita Sutras, all this stuff comes from vast depth to be turned into, well, the Dharma by Nagarjuna, with the aim of presenting Dharma. Yeah. So, why is Nagarjuna considered so important? He rescued Buddhism from reification by reasserting the doctrine of Anatman. So I'm going to get the jargon police on my tail for this. Reification is that thing of believing that something that we have a concept for is actually real and actually exists. So it's what I've been on about not doing for all of this talk and most of the last one as well. Just because we have a thing called the in-breath, that doesn't mean it really exists. Or a breathe, or a breather, right? That is simply breathing, that is simply that. We break it up into compartments and conceptualise it. That's a very handy way of describing it, a neat conceptual framework, but it isn't real. It's just a way of holding it. It's not a final description of what is real. Understand that thoroughly and you really have got something important. And the Buddha is absolutely famous in history for asserting not Atman, or the doctrine of the soul, or the permanent existence of some part of the being, but Anatman. There is nothing there. The person is empty. That's the really frightening idea at the heart of all this. That's the touch of shunyata, as we sometimes call it, and it's very scary when you really give it some attention. So what Nagarjuna does is he rescues the Dharma from getting fixed, well, for turning into Buddhism and maybe even Shuddhism. Another example of Shuddhism that comes to mind, Sri Lankan monks are not allowed to touch money. And so they do it by wearing gloves. Sounds pretty shuddist to me, that, you know. That's not really the spirit of the Vinaya, the monastic code. So the Buddha taught that emptiness is universal, but in the centuries following his death, this degenerated into the view that only the self is empty, and ironically enough, a form of practice focused on personal enlightenment came into being. How you focus on individual enlightenment on the basis that there's no individual, I don't really know. It's the kind of thing that happens when a tradition has lost its way a bit. Yeah? And Sangharakshita, who founded this movement, describes Nagarjuna's achievement in the strongest possible terms as the correction of a heresy. You really can't get stronger talk than that in religious or philosophical discourse. Heresy is one of those really big, scary words, yeah? In a sense, Nagarjuna saves the Dharma. But how does he do it? Right, this might be a bit fast, but let's see what I can do. The atomic unit, if you like, of Buddhism is something called the Dharma. It's one of those words with lots and lots and lots of different meanings. We have the Dharma, capital D, which is, I've spoken about, is the direct experience of reality or the conceptual formulation which points towards it. The Abhidharma tradition, following the Buddha, did a very elegant and useful job of analysing all that into what amounts to something we might call a psychology, a sort of philosophical psychology. And all that stuff that you get in meditation, all those instructions about the hindrances and so on, they're all based upon that neat, elegant, Abhidharmic analysis of mental states, how dhyana arises and how it's blocked and so on. Yeah, and I'm doing at the moment with my mitra study group. An endless, it seems, study of the Yamachara Abhidharma, which I think has proven very useful, because those ideas, that analysis, people can connect that to their experience very directly. Okay, so this is useful stuff. However, it's not Dharma. It's a very good way to prepare yourself and orientate yourself in order to move up, if you like. So what happens is that basic unit came to be seen as ultimately real. The self may not exist really, but there were irreducible atomic units to experience. One example, there's a great little example in Sangharakshita's Survey of Buddhism, his big tome from the mid-50s, where he talks about watching a film and then moving down to the front of it. All you can see are the dots, like just seeing the pixels rather than the picture. Very beautiful image, that. And the idea of looking at things at the dharmic level, small d, at the level of basic elements, at the level at which things are either negative, positive, or neutral, end of, that simple sort of feeling tone, or Vedanara as we call it, is very, very useful indeed. Because he says, you'll be watching what seems to be a great romantic and historical drama with this, that, and the other going on. And when you get down, there's a bunch of dots. And both perspectives are worth having, you know? The idea that you tell yourself this story about your life and experience with just a bunch of dots is quite an interesting corrective, with the idea that it's all terribly real. But if it gets stuck there, then you end up with saying, well, reality is just dots, isn't it? And that won't do, because that isn't what the Buddha taught. Nagarjuna splits the atom, if you like. He demonstrates that all dharmas are empty. Sabba dhamma anatta, in the famous formulation in the Pali. And that includes emptiness itself, which is no more real than anything else, such that emptiness too is empty. And Nagarjuna points, therefore, to the emptiness of emptiness. It's cute, weird music at this point, because this is starting to get very, very strange. Yeah? There's a strong risk that we will say, that's it, it's emptiness, we've got it. Not it. Emptiness itself is empty. The Heart Sutta really does tell you this over and over and over again. Yeah? Now, this is the foundation of the Mahayana. Maha in all the languages of India, I believe, certainly in Hindi, means the big one, the great one. Yeah? So the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, I refer to as the great being, the Mahasattva. The Mahayana is the great vehicle. And rather than being based upon a private, personal enlightenment, as if that were possible, the Mahayana is based upon outgoing cosmic altruism and the ideal of the Bodhisattva. And those of you with a good sense to stick around for Shantideva will be hearing about the ultimate analyst and presenter and poet of the Bodhisattva's life. But don't miss the last bit of the Bodhicaryavatara, where he talks about wisdom, because that's very, very philosophically strong as well. It's a very balanced work, actually, even though it's ecstatic and poetic as well. So that's another polarity, isn't it, between, you know, the philosophical and the poetic. Are they one and the same thing? Are they different? How can they be combined? Where's the middle way there? So the Bodhisattva ideal is the wisdom being who works ceaselessly for the liberation of all beings and the perfect knowledge that no such beings actually exist. Which is one of those, ooh, things that you hear. Now that's the level of understanding from which Bodhidharma is operating, as the Emperor Wu struggles to comprehend, at least according to the traditional story. Even if this never happened, it matters that the tradition maintains that view of it. So Wu is just a fall guy, in a sense. I'm just trying to do justice to the guy, because he was a real historical character. I wouldn't want to be bad-mouthing him all these years on. The Emperor Wu and Bodhidharma are clearly operating on different levels. They can be seen as opposed. Wu is the naif, and Bodhidharma is the wizard, the great wizard who sorts him out, and yet they're also connected. Bodhidharma does not dismiss Wu's Buddhist practice, but he places it within such a vast context that it seems to shrink. Like, who is this you that seeks merit? Is really what he's asking. He doesn't. He does this in the kind of, you know, the no-messing Zen style, I suppose. That's it. He doesn't explain, doesn't take his time, doesn't worry about using jargon. He just does it, which is a start. If you do it all the time, you lose your audience. If you don't do it once in a while, everybody falls asleep. Zen master Dogen, who created the Soto tradition, says, those who see worldly life as an obstacle to Dharma and see no Dharma in everyday actions, they have not discovered that there are no everyday actions outside of Dharma. So you don't need Shuddhism, and ultimately Buddhism is just a ladder you climb, or a raft that you use to cross the water, to use the Buddha's classic analogy, and you don't carry it on your back once you've made your way across. Yeah? So the Dharma and ultimately Dharma are the point. Right? But it's a bit like criticising your boots when you haven't walked there yet. You know? You've still got to use them, because this is where we are. We are where we are. Yeah? The deep view on Bodhidharma and Wu is they're both correct on their own level. Now that is my approach to what is known as Nagarjuna's doctrine of the two truths, rather than the absolute. Now, people have written whole books on this, whole PhD thesis, and I'm going to give it about 5 minutes. So, you know, bear with me. It's just a start, just scratch the surface of this. Relative truth is truth considered at the everyday level. So when I said any fool knows that we breathe, that's relative truth. We can't deny that. Experience occurs. We have experience. No credible account of our lives is going to leave that out. It's got to find that a place somewhere in its analysis. 2 and 2 is 4. Every time, you know, again and again. Absolute truth, however, is the inherent emptiness of all phenomena, in which there is no 2, no 4, no plus, and no equals. How can both be true? Crack that, and you're quite a long way towards enlightenment. This is how emptiness actually works, and it makes the spiritual life possible. If things were not empty, they would all be stuck. It's unimaginable. So weird as this stuff sounds, it is also profoundly familiar. We have seen that there is breathing. Who can deny yet that? And yet nowhere is there a breather to be found. Strange as it sounds, it's actually quite ordinary. We have always known this, because it's how things actually are. So what happens as you shake off the Shuddhism and get into the Buddhism and start looking at the Dharma and getting a hint of what Dharma might be like, is that you realise that it's all ordinary. It's, yeah. And I think that accounts for the common experience, which I think some of you here must have had, of thinking, you hear some Dharma presentation, you think, I've always known that. That's not some new thing which I'm going to acquire and put in my pocket and keep. It's like, yeah, that's it. Correct. You all experienced that? Hands up if you've experienced that sense of familiarity. Of course, yes, quite. I once had a talk by Subhuti, one of our terribly senior order members, in which he translated that sadhu, which you hear in the Refuge and Precepts, as quite. It's very English, and so the quite has great force. Okay, so for sure this can seem perplexing. Those of you who are now going, have all my sympathy. Yeah? I feel the same way, but I'm just sticking at it. Hang on in there. This is only the total destruction of everything that we have ever known in the name of all that is most deeply familiar. You want a Zen koan? Try that one. Yeah? The total destruction of everything we've ever known in the name of all that is most deeply familiar. But we are Buddhists. We have Dharma. We have the advanced technology and the wild, fearless courage. We can cope with this. Nagarjuna understands that we find this stuff difficult. Because of something called prapancha, another jargon alert. Prapancha, really good word to get your head around, to understand, and with very great relevance to your experience. All that mental proliferation on the cushion, yeah, all that whiz, that's prapancha. That's the tendency of the mind, the unenlightened mind, the mundane mind, to just whiz off and do stuff. You sit down to meditate, you know, you take the first breath, so you suddenly find yourself counting to 47, and all you're thinking about is cake. Uh-oh. You know, and that's classic in any beginner's meditation classes. Just start counting again, you know. And how hard is that? Now, Nagarjuna is going straight for that. He's going for that proliferation. Yeah? His method is called nisprapancha, a negation of prapancha, non-proliferation, stripping down to the bare essentials of raw experience, which is what meditation on a good day is like. Yeah? To practice nisprapancha is to sign a non-proliferation treaty with your own mind, seems to me. Now, this uncompromising insistence upon absolute simplicity and directness is at the heart of Dharma and the Dharma. And most often you can see it in Buddhism as well. It's often seen as the spirit of Zen. But Zen got it from China, and China got it from India via Bodhidharma, and Bodhidharma got it from the Buddha, because Dharma is Dharma, Ekayana, one tradition. This is absolutely fundamental. And in an Ekayana movement like ourselves, one way in which we are seeking to place the essence of the tradition in a new cultural context, that's an insight of great importance. Yeah? So, onto the book with a big name, the Mulamajjhamakarika. Nagarjuna sets out his approach in a number of key texts, the principle of which is the Mulamajjhamakarika, which translates from the Sanskrit as fundamental verses on the middle way. So let's just break that one down. Mula, fundamental, root, base, foundation, that kind of thing to it, yeah? Majjhamaka, the middle way, as a method or as a philosophy. But as we'll see, if it's a philosophy, it's a funny kind of philosophy. That's the school founded by Nagarjuna, and it's absolutely fundamental to the whole Buddhist tradition. The two main schools at Nalanda were the Majjhamaka, which tends to look like philosophical analysis, and the Yogacara, which is very big on experience and meditation. You roll the two together into something called the Prasangika Majjhamaka, and you've got the basis of Tibetan Buddhism, which the Dalai Lama himself says is the highest achievement of human philosophical or religious life. So this is big stuff. This matters. We would have a higher opinion of it if we hadn't been raised to see everything as coming from the Mediterranean. They were ignoring China and India. We think that all philosophy comes from the Greeks and the Romans, and all religion comes from the Middle East. It's a big misunderstanding, that. As Buddhists, however, we're interested in what's called the Indosphere, which includes Cambodia, and that whole area. You think about where Buddhism traditionally is located on the map. That's the Indosphere, that's the place under the influence of India. And because, of course, Britain conquered India, and in a sense invented it, it was rather slow to realise what was going on there, but, you know, it kind of crept up on the imperial consciousness. There's a great book called The Buddha and the Sahibs, which is all about how most of the important discoveries of the Buddhist sites and ideas and so on were actually done by off-duty cavalry officers who went into the bush for a few days with their bearers and discovered the caves at Ajanta and I don't know what else, you know. So, you know, the British kind of conquered and then got conquered, which happens to conquerors sometimes. So, Karika means verses. So, Mula Majjhama Karika, fundamental verses on the middle way. It's important to understand what a Karika is. A Karika is, think about the oral tradition in monastic training. A lot of stuff got to be committed to memory because, you know, you've got to, even if there is writing, you've got to punch with a stylus on a palm leaf. It's not quick. Okay? A karika, then, is an extremely condensed verse which a student would commit to memory. And it doesn't make a whole lot of sense unless it's accompanied by volumes of commentary. So if you just sit down with a Sanskrit dictionary, even though Devan tells me that Nagarjuna's Sanskrit is fairly straightforward, you're going to get a lot of very obscure stuff. I'll give you a verse in a moment, give you a sense of what it's like. But the volumes of commentary are part of the deal, and the idea is that it should attract commentary, and indeed the Mahamudra Karaka has attracted more commentary than you can shake a stick at. Yeah? Still, to this day, new books appear. Yeah? So students would use the Karaka verses memorised, yeah, as a basis for expounding the main points of commentary. So that would be their mnemonic, their clue. They think about that verse, oh yeah, that's my remember. And so they'd be able to teach from that. Very efficient way of doing things, yeah? Nagarjuna founded Nalanda, still the oldest university in the world, over 1,000 years of existence, from 200 until 1200, the Common Era. Makes those upstarts Bologna and Oxford, like newcomers. Not often appreciated that because of that Mediterraneanist bias. Nalanda, still the oldest university in the world. Yeah? And what I'm talking about gives you some idea of what was on the curriculum at Nalanda. You get a sense of what you might have studied in the philosophy class with Nagarjuna or one of his students. And Nagarjuna's connection to the original teachings of the Buddha is quite clear. The Mahamudra Karaka is very famous for taking as its starting point a sutta from the Pali Canon, the original records of the Buddha's teaching. And I read that out in my last talk. It's a conversation, a brief dialogue between Katayana and the Buddha, in which the Buddha basically says, polarized thinking is out, the middle way lies between all extremes. And he talks about the state of a world in which polarized dogma is very, very dominant, and it's as fresh as just now. Yeah. The relevance of that sutta is as great now as it ever was. So let's take just the first verse of the Mahamudra Karaka, in which Nagarjuna goes straight for it, because that's his style. He talks about the nature of cause and effect, what we call cause and effect in the West, or pratityasamutpada, as it's known. Another term which, sooner or later, you're going to have to get your head around if you're going to be serious about your Buddhism. Pratityasamutpada, yeah? Conditioned co-production, how things come into being, how they pass out of being, which is addressed in the Katayanagata Sutta. So the very first verse of the Mahamudra Karaka says, this is Garfield's translation, neither from itself, nor from another, nor from both, nor without a cause, does anything whatever anywhere arise. You're left thinking, okay, what's he saying here? Neither from itself, nor from another, nor from both, nor without a cause, does anything or ever anywhere arise. Right, now those of you who were listening last time recognise the tetralemma, or the Chaturskoti as it's known in Indian logic. It's not A, it's not B, it's not both A and B, and it isn't neither A nor B either. So he's doing that with cause and effect, which to a Westerner is pretty disorientating, and really quite exciting too, if he can pull it off. He is saying that cause and effect are not ultimately real, they're just ideas. They're just names, if you like, the name for the in-breath, the name for the out-breath. Yeah? Cause cannot be the same as effect, or they would not be different, and you wouldn't see the difference between them. You think there's a difference between them. If they're the same, then that can't be the case. And if they're different, well, they can't be different either, because they couldn't be connected. You cannot show a relationship between cause and effect when considered as fixed, definite entities. Well, there's your paradox, there's your impasse. And the Buddhist tradition is very good at setting up paradoxes and then resolving them by going to another level. Sangharakshita says a difficulty cannot be solved at its own level. A difficulty can be solved at its own level, but a problem has to be solved at a higher level than where it is. So this difficulty, considered as a problem, can be solved at a higher level. One way to do that was to say, well, let's just take a modern theory like emergence, in which neither cause nor effect are separate. These are just aspects of the process. You see the wave coming into the shore, the water's different all the time, but you think there's something there, you know it's not really there. It's just an emergent phenomenon. It's how ants manage to be smart. Ant colonies manage to be smart, but ants certainly aren't. Because as a whole, they're very intelligent. You can't find that intelligence in the individual parts. So it's a field of unfolding conditions in constant dynamic flow within which nothing is fixed. As long as you drop that idea of a fixed cause and a fixed effect, there's just a kind of flowering. Yeah? Everything that you need to know about Pranayaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, is right there in the Heart Sutra. And this is Nagarjuna logic as poetry. The Bodhisattva holding to nothing whatever but dwelling in pranaya wisdom is freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it, and reaches clearest nirvana. So these are not just clever ideas. These are what Buddhism calls a soteriological purpose, a term we nick from Christian theology, which means concerned with the salvation of the individual, concerned with individual well-being. Take away the theism from that, and that's what I said at the beginning, is that your Dharma teaching must be soteriological, which means you don't often use words like soteriological. But that means it's about helping people to do better, to be more focused, more concentrated, you know, to live the Dharma life to more fully, to better effect. No point in it otherwise. So Nagarjuna would seem to be the great philosopher, but what we have here is the transcendence of mere philosophy. He's a bit like Socrates, who strikes me as not quite a philosopher either, but wiser than that. Certainly Nagarjuna's, you know, in the sort of top 10, top 5 possibly, is the greatest philosopher in human history. And he's one of ours, so it's good to have him on the team, I think. But he's much more than this, because the Madhyamacharaka systematically annihilates all intellectual positions. Which is a slightly odd thing for a philosopher to do, because according to the Western tradition, philosophers are supposed to work out the ultimate conceptual description of what is going on. And yet those of you who know their Wittgenstein will know that at the end of the Tractatus, he says, that of which we cannot speak, we must pass over in silence, which is his most zen moment, and makes Wittgenstein quite an interesting bloke, actually. And he's getting pretty close to the Nagarjuna position there. The Madhyamacharaka uses a relentless dialectical method to demonstrate the inherent contradiction of all conceptual descriptions of reality. Western analytic philosophy says that if we're just smart enough, we can work out what's going on. And Nagarjuna says, nope, not going to happen. Reality is beyond conceptual designation. You cannot capture it. It is not fixed. It will always escape. Those writhing snakes come to mind. Yeah? The Buddha once said, I think of karma actually, that it's difficult to grasp and as dangerous to grasp wrongly as a water snake. That image you're trying to pick up a snake when you're doing this kind of stuff seems quite compelling to me, really. If this is the ultimate triumph of intellect, a brilliant exercise of intellect which reveals the limits of intellect and leaves no refuge in mere conceptualizing, then it's only the direct experience of reality. So what Nagarjuna does is he takes the intellect to its absolute limit, destroys all intellectual positions. So this is not intellectual philosophy, it's trans-intellectual. It's the exercise of intellect throughout the rest of that text where every possible objection to his position is shown up to be contradictory or absurd in terms of intellectual regression and so on. He shows that he cannot describe the nature of things. I mean, even starting off as saying, actually, cause and effect don't exist in the way you think about them, which is a shocker for starters, and it gets worse. He sometimes talks about mere philosophers being like a man on a horse who forgets that there's two things there, thinks it's all one. Does that all the way through. Says some very interesting things about what fire is like and firewood and all the rest of it. So that's enough to be going on with. Over to you. I've got some questions for your discussion groups. Try these. Has your spiritual life led you into any train wrecks? Has your spiritual life led you into any train wrecks yet? Or is that something still to look forward to? Specifically, has your practice of Buddhism ever led you into head-on collision with Dharma or the Dharma? Ever had a Wu Bodhidharma moment? If not, what do you make of the idea that this will happen? My assertion that you stick at this stuff, that's going to happen, and it's not going to be nice, but it will be okay. Just keep coming. And if that didn't happen to you, what do you make of the idea that it will happen? What did happen, and what do you learn from it? So, do you want to get into discussion groups and have a chat about that?
Thank you very much.